The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Respiratory failure, ventilator therapy, and pulmonary function testing is presented by Dr. Thomas Morley.
Well, good morning. I apologize in advance. This topic is kind of schizophrenic. None of it really touches on it too well, but I'm going to try and stress in each topic what you're likely to be asked as far as boards are concerned. I have no disclosures because I have no money. The first thing we're going to talk about is acute respiratory failure. And there's a lot of ways to define it and a lot of ways to organize it, but at the heart of it, respiratory failure has to do with the respiratory system, and that is the heart and the lungs, aren't able to meet the metabolic requirements of the organism, and the organism is us. And there's, as I say, there's a lot of different ways we could classify it. There's an anatomic etiologic classification, a physiologic etiologic classification. The blood gas classification is the one that we use most frequently, the one I'll stress. I'll talk a little bit about radiology and respiratory failure and a bit about tissue oxygenation. And I would say that respiratory failure is a cellular event. It's not just the heart fails or the lungs fail. It's something wrong at the tissue level that leads to lactic acidosis and cell death. Now, this is an example of the anatomic etiologic classification. And in this one, you think of the respiratory system as a chain of events, the brain, the spinal nerves, the muscles, the lungs. And anywhere along the line, if there's a break in that chain, you have respiratory failure. The problem with this classification is that it's not very helpful at the bedside. Oftentimes when people come into the hospital, we don't know where the chain is broken. And similarly, the physiologic etiologic classification. We can think of certain physiologic events that occur and that lead to respiratory failure. And it got inadequate respiratory muscle function is very common, such as neuromuscular diseases. Excessive workload, people have ARDS or pneumonia, the workload's excessive and the patients fail. Or there's inadequate respiratory drive, people overdose or they get alkalotic, the respiratory drive mechanism goes down. But again, same thing, we don't really know a lot of times when people come in exactly where the physiology of the respiratory failure is. And because of that, we came up with a more practical way of looking at respiratory failure. And that basically is looking at the blood glass cast. And people are either hypoxemic, they're hypercapnic, or they're both. It's a very practical system. It can also help us to figure out the etiology. People get hypoxemic for certain reasons, people get hypercapnic for different reasons, and it can help us in terms of our treatment. And also, it's readily available. Now, what the lungs basically are supposed to do, they're supposed to get oxygen from the atmosphere into the blood and get rid of carbon dioxide. In order for that to happen, there has to be a proper ratio. The same amount of ventilation has to go to the lung, and a similar amount of blood flow has to go to the lung. If inadequate ventilation occurs, then oxygen doesn't get into the blood, and we end up with hypoxemia. Now, how do we know whether blood gas exchange is good or bad? Well, one of the classic ones we use, we look at the alveolar arterial oxygen gradient. What should happen, we can calculate how much oxygen should be in the alveolus, and this is the equation. And you can see that from the equation that the alveolar oxygen is going to depend on how much oxygen we're breathing, but also the barometric pressure. For example, if you're on top of Mount Everest, the barometric pressure goes down, and your oxygen, your blood's going to go down, not because there's anything wrong with gas exchange, but just because there's less oxygen in the air that you breathe. And you also say in the second part of the equation, the amount of oxygen in the alveolus is also going to depend on the carbon dioxide. As carbon dioxide goes up in the blood, alveolar oxygen is going to go down. So we'll talk more about that in a minute. And then we can also measure the arterial oxygen. If gas exchange is occurring normally, the alveolar and the arterial oxygen should be pretty close to each other. There shouldn't be much of a gradient. If there is a big gradient, then something's wrong with gas exchange. And the bigger the gradient, the worse gas exchange is. Right. So this is an example of somebody has a shunt physiology, kind of the worst case scenario in case of hypoxemia. And what they're showing you here is that if you completely block ventilation to a portion of the lung, what happens is the mixed venous blood that goes through that area of the lung is going to have no oxygen, it's going to have no gas exchange, so it's going to be just as hypoxemic when it comes out as when it comes in. And even if you put the person on very high oxygen, put them on 100% oxygen, there's still not any way to get the PaO2 up. So shunt is kind of the worst case scenario in terms of or hypoxemia. More commonly what happens, though, is that somebody has, no, I'm sorry, this is, more commonly what happens is that people have a little bit of ventilation to the lung. Instead of being 1-to-1, it might be 0.1-to-1. And in that situation, the person will go hypoxemic, but when you put them on 100% oxygen, their PaO2 comes up again. So that you can differentiate shunt physiology from low VQ by just putting the person on 100% oxygen. Now, two things I want to say about this slide. At the bottom of the slide, it shows the low ventilation perfusion and the shunt physiology. And probably the most important thing about low VQ and shunt is that when you put somebody on that has like pneumonia, low VQ, that sort of thing, on 100% oxygen, their PaO2 comes up. If they have shunt physiology, when you put them on 100% oxygen, it does not come up for the reasons that we just said. At the top of the slide, we have low FiO2, which is somebody on top of Mount Everest. There's a low barometric pressure. And that sort of a person, the person's hypoxemic, but their AA gradient is normal. That is, because there's not much oxygen in the alveolus, the person gets hypoxemic. But the alveolar arterial oxygen gradient remains relatively normal. Same thing with somebody who has hypoventilation. When the alveolar CO2 goes up, it displaces oxygen, but the alveolar arterial oxygen stays normal. So I just would emphasize that. Now, CO2 is simpler in a way. The arterial CO2 is dependent on a proportionality constant. It's proportional on the rate at which we generate CO, how much CO2 we make, and it's also inversely proportional to the alveolar ventilation. Now, when you look at the cause of hypercapnia, alterations in CO2 production generally do not lead to hypercapnia. And the reason is simple, is that when we generate more CO2, it stimulates our carotid bodies and our receptors in our brain, the pH receptors, and it increases our minute ventilation. So that most people, if they're febrile or they're exercising or things like that, our CO2 does not rise. On the other hand, people that have something wrong with their lungs, they have COPD or whatever, asthma, whatever, in that situation, their alveolar ventilation is limited, and because of that, their CO2 goes up. Similarly, with the people have kyphoscoliotic lung disease or something wrong with the chest wall or the bellows, in that situation, they can't generate adequate minute ventilation, and alveolar CO2 rises. And finally, changes in ventilatory control. Somebody overdoses on opiates or is severely alkalotic, they'll retain CO2 on that basis. Now, I just want to spend a minute talking about the radiographic classification of respiratory failure. And it's pretty simple. We talk about white lung. Usually people have white lungs, they're going to be hypoxemic. People that have black lungs, such as emphysema, are going to be hypercapnic. That's a gross oversimplification, but we only have 30 minutes. So. Now, this is a person that has a pneumonia in the right mid lobe. This would be a good example of what somebody that would have low ventilation perfusion, that you put them on 3 liters of oxygen, their PO2 comes back up normally. Same thing as here in the lateral. This is a person that has atelectasis of the right upper lobe. You can see the trachea is deviated over, the horizontal fissures deviated upwards. The right lung actually looks smaller than the left lung. So this is somebody that has gross atelectasis. This would be the kind of person, if you put them on 100% oxygen, their PaO2 might not improve because they're not ventilating that segment of the lung, but they're continuing to perfuse it. This is the worst case scenario. Somebody has acute respiratory distress syndrome. You put this person on 100% oxygen, their PaO2 is 50, so that the lung is acting like shunt physiology. Blood's going into the lung and it's coming out with the same oxygen saturations that it went in with. It's just miliary TB, another white lung. This is pulmonary fibrosis. You can see that the lungs are smaller than they should be. Another example of white lung, another person that would be hypoxemic. This is just pulmonary edema. This is pleural effusion, you get the point. But those are all white lungs, things that people get hypoxic from. This is the black lung people. This is somebody that has alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. The lungs are very big and black. There's bullous disease in the lower lobes. And this would be typical of somebody that would have hypercapnic respiratory failure because of an increase in dead space and low alveolar ventilation. This is plain old run-of-the-mill emphysema, gross liver inflation, the heart looks like a pea, and a person's retaining CO2 on that basis. This is just the increased AP diameter, increased retrosternal airspace, diaphragms flat as a board, somebody that has emphysema. This is not a diagnostic challenge. This is somebody that has a pneumothorax. You see the lung looks like a ball in the right lower lung field, and there's an air fluid level because there's a hemopneumothorax. Now, what we just talked about was hypoxemic and hypercapnic respiratory failure. And that's the first, the ventilatory failure and the failure of arterial oxygenation. Right underneath that, there's a failure of oxygen delivery. Even if the O2 in the blood is good and the CO2 in the blood is good, the tissues can still be impaired. The way that would happen is that somebody has any kind of cardiogenic shock, or they're not perfusing blood to the tissues, or if somebody's profoundly anemic, they can't carry enough oxygen to the tissues. What happens is that there's not going to be as much oxygen delivered to the tissue, and the tissues are going to extract more oxygen from the blood. As a result of that, the mixed venous oxygen tension and content are going to be lower. On the other hand, if people have their oxygen delivery is good, their CO2 is good, their oxygen is good, but you can still have failure of oxygen utilization where the tissues can't utilize the oxygen. Cyanide poisoning would be an example of that. A more common example would be people that have sepsis. And people that have sepsis, they can't extract the oxygen from the blood that's presented. And because of that, the mixed venous oxygen tension is going to be inappropriately high. And that's how we can deliver that. And that's kind of outlined on the slide. Now, next couple of slides, we're going to talk about mechanical ventilation. And this is an ancient slide from Hardy Tobin. It's just as good now as it was with the day he made it. And what are our objectives when we put people on mechanical ventilation? Well, we want to improve gas exchange. We want to make the hypoxemia better. We want to make the hypercapnia better. We want to relieve the respiratory distress. Usually, when we're sitting here, our respiratory muscles consume maybe 3% of our resting oxygen consumption. When people go into respiratory failure, they can go up to 5, 10, 15, almost 20% when it's very bad. So you can overwork the respiratory muscles to the point that they fail. One of the most important things we're talking about in a minute is that we want to permit the lung to heal, but also we want to avoid damaging the lung. And for a long time, we didn't think that mechanical ventilation damages the lungs, but in point of fact, it does, and I'll show you how in a minute. Now, just a couple of things about CPAP and BiPAP. CPAP is a way to keep the airway open or to keep the lung open, to increase the volume at the end of exhalation. CPAP does not augment somebody's mitral ventilation. It doesn't make them breathe more. It doesn't blow off their CO2. So that if you want to blow off somebody's CO2, you have to use BiPAP. But by using BiPAP, you give them two pressure, one during inhalation, one during exhalation. And the bigger that difference in pressure is, the more you help to inflate the lung and the more CO2 that you can blow off. So again, CPAP is to keep the recruit lung and keep the lung open, improve oxygenation. BiPAP is what's useful if you have respiratory failure. It's most useful in people that have CHF and COPD. Now, the notion of barotrauma. We used to think that when people had damage to the lung, it was because the pressure. We would expose the lung to excessive amounts of pressure, and that would cause the lung to become damaged. But in point of fact, that's not the case. And the reason it's not the case is that generally when we measure airway pressures, we measure approximately up by the upper airway, up by the endotracheal tube. And that's not where the lung gets damaged. The lung gets damaged down by the alveolar. Here, for example, they just give you an example of the slide. You may have a peak airway pressure at the tube of 50, but the alveolar pressure may only be 20 or 10 or some lower value. So that looking at the proximal airway pressure doesn't give you a good idea of whether you're going to damage the lung or not. And this is just an old experiment what they did in animals. At the first slide there, they ventilated the animal and really didn't cause any alveolar overdistension, didn't do any damage to the lung. The second lung, they gave them a little bit higher pressure for a longer period of time, caused more overdistension of the lung, and you can see that the lung started to look a little damaged. The final one there, they kept the animal on high pressure with overdistension for about 20 minutes. And at the end of the 20 minutes, you can see the lung's almost destroyed. It's hemorrhagic, it's swollen. And we try not to do this, but the notion here is that it's not the pressure that kills you, it's the alveolar overdistension. They've also done animal experiments where they would put bands around the lungs so that they would prevent the lungs from overdistending even though they were exposed to a high pressure. And what they found was is that the animals that they didn't let the lungs overdistend, their lungs were just fine. The ones that they left unbanded, they get alveolar overdistension, they get damage. So it's not the pressure, it's the overdistension. Excuse me. So I forget that. I'll go back 1 second ago. All right. So how do we know whether that the lungs are overdistended? Now, when we look at the ventilator, all we know is the person's breathing in 500 or 400 cc's, whatever we tell it. But it matters what the volume is along at the end of exhalation. And what they're showing you here, I don't know if I can, I can't really point it, but maybe I can point it here. If you look over here, what we want to ventilate people is here, where there's small changes in pressure cause large changes in lung volume. If we have too much air inside the lung, we keep it too inflated, what happens is that we start breathing the patient up here. And when you do that, that's when the lung's going to be overinflated. So that we need a way to identify whether the lung's overinflated or not. And the way that we do that is called the plateau pressure. And what they're showing you here is that this is the peak airway pressure. And once the volume of air is inside the lung, we block the lung so the air can't get out. And then we let the lung recoil against that lung volume. And that pressure is called the plateau pressure. When you have alveolar overdistension, or there's too much air in the lung, that plateau pressure gets higher and higher and higher. And we can measure that at the bedside. If the plateau pressure is higher than about 30, that's when we get nervous that we're going to have barotrauma and damage to the lung. And so that's an important part about that. The only thing I might mention about ARDS is that one of the ways in the old days that we used to damage lungs is we used too high a titer volume. We would use 10, 15 cc's per kilogram of body weight. And the rationale for doing it was is that when you did that, you'd get more uniform distribution of gas throughout the lung. The problem with doing that is that when you use those high titer volumes, that's when you get the plateau pressures up to those high numbers, and that's what you end up getting lung damage. So nowadays, when we have ARDS patients, we don't use that 10 cc's. We use about 5 cc's per kilogram of their ideal body weight. When people get heavy, just because you're heavy doesn't make your lungs any bigger, so you have to use ideal body weight. Auto PEEP, I just want to mention, because they may or may not have a question about this. Regular PEEP is something that we deliberately apply. We apply resistance to the airway, and we keep the end expired pressure at a higher level. Auto PEEP is something that happens inadvertently. And the reason it happens most of the time is that we got so much air going in and out of the lung, there's not enough time for all the air to come out at the end of exhalation. And we call that auto PEEP. And if you have high minute ventilations, the higher your minute ventilation, the greater the likelihood you're going to end up with auto PEEP. And it makes sense. The more air you put in and out, the less time there is for the air to come out at exhalation. Most of the time we have auto PEEP, it can occur either with hyperventilation with airway obstruction. It can occur in people that you just give too high a minute ventilation to, like ARDS patients. And if the person breathes out against the machine, they can create their own auto PEEP. Now, the only thing I'm going to emphasize for they might test you on is that how do you know somebody has auto PEEP? We talked about plateau pressure. That's how we know we have alveolar overdistension. How do we know that we have auto PEEP? Well, this is inhalation, this is exhalation on the bottom, and this is flow. If somebody has auto PEEP and you look at their expiratory flow, as you look at the end of expiration, their flow has not come back to zero. They're still trying to get the air out. So if you see that, you know they have auto PEEP in presence. All right. The problem with auto PEEP is that it's something that occurs at the alveolar level. It's something we can't measure directly. So how do we measure auto PEEP? With auto PEEP, at the end of exhalation, we block any further breathing. And we allow time for the distal alveolar pressures to equilibrate with the proximal airway pressure. And what they're showing you here, this is auto PEEP. We allow that time, the pressure equilibrates, and you see this, and you can measure the auto PEEP by doing that. So that in order to measure whether you have alveolar overdistension, you look for a plateau pressure. In order to measure auto PEEP, you want to measure the end of exhalation. Apparently, the only important thing for you guys to remember about how do you get rid of it, if you want to get rid of auto PEEP, what you want to do is give them less minute ventilation. Decrease their titer volume, decrease their titer volume and respiratory rate. What's the downside about doing that? What's going to happen? They're going to retain CO2, and we call that permissive hypercapnia. We let them retain CO2 in order to protect their lungs. And that's all we need to do about that. Now, just one thing I want to mention about it's not new anymore. The old definition was from 1994 for acute respiratory distress syndrome. And they changed it because there was some new data. So the new definition, it's called the Berlin definition for ARDS, looks at the severity of air gas and it grades it by mild, moderate, severe. And the the grade is based on what the the arterial FiO2 ratio is. And if you have somebody on 100% and their PO2 is 100, that's very bad for you. That means that they're required a high oxygen concentration. And again, it goes from 200 to 300, 100 to 200, and less than 100. The reason that's important is that those severities also correlate with the mortality for the patient. If you have a mild disease, mortality is still going to be about 27%. Severe disease can be up into the 45% range. So that the again, that does correlate with the severity of disease. Also, it has to be acute disease. When you talk about if somebody's got pulmonary fibrosis, that's not somebody that has ARDS. This is an acute process that usually affects both lungs. And by definition, they don't have heart failure. Now, last couple of minutes, we want to spend talking about pulmonary function testing. And when we do our unknowns, I'm going to show you some unknowns. We'll talk about interpretation in a minute. But pulmonary function testing is spirometry. We take a deep breath in, blow all the air out. Most important thing about spirometry is, can you know the total lung volume by measuring spirometry? Can you know total lung capacity? And the answer is no. When you do spirometry, you blow all the air out, and there's always a certain amount of air left in your lungs. It's called the residual volume. And the residual volume is very important. But for pulmonary function testing, if you only do spirometry, you can't really know how big the lungs are. You have to do measure their total lung volumes. Okay. We can also measure reversibility. We'll talk more about that. We'll talk a little bit about methacholine challenge testing. I'm not going to talk at all about exercise or diffusing capacity. Now, why do we do pulmonary function tests? Lots of different reasons. Number one, we want to see if they have disease and how bad it is. We want to see if there's the screen for subclinical disease where they're, for example, somebody's exposed to asbestos and we want to see if they're developing any damage. Also, severity of the disease. We want to determine the severity. We also, in like asthma and that kind of stuff, we want to see reversibility. We want to see the person get better. We can follow the course of disease over time. And finally, we may want to evaluate the person preoperatively. Now, this is a simple volume time curve. This is when they first developed pulmonary function testing. This is what we measured. And we have the person take a deep breath in to their total lung capacity. They blow the air out as hard and fast as they can until they get to their forced vital capacity. And the amount of air they blow out in one second is called the FEV1. And this is a big example, and people have the red line is the normal, and then the other two lines are obstruction. And two things about this. One thing is when you have obstructive lung disease, you never plateau. You just keep blowing the air out, so you don't really get that rapid plateau that you see in a normal patient. Also, as the person's severity goes down, so does the vital capacity. The vital capacity goes down, not because the lungs are small, but because the air gets trapped inside the lung and they can't get it out. Also, when disease is severe, the FEV1 is going to go down. The more severe the person's disease is, the more severe the reduction in the FEV1 is going to be. Now, compare that to somebody who has restrictive. That's the little orange line there. It's the person who has restricted lung disease. Here, the person doesn't get to the normal vital capacity, but they plateau fine. The air comes out. They reach a plateau very quickly. They don't have this obstructive pattern where they keep going up and up. Now, in terms of differentiating obstruction from restriction, you can have a reduced FEV1 from having obstructive lung disease or having restrictive lung disease. So how do we differentiate between those two things? The most important thing is looking at the ratio between the FEV1 and the FVC. If somebody has restrictive lung disease, the FEV1 goes down and the FVC goes down, but they both go down to the same extent, so that the ratio between the two stays relatively normal. In people who have COPD, the FE1 goes down more than the FVC, and because of that, the ratio is going to be lower and lower. So that people that have restrictive lung disease, their FE1, FVC ratio is going to be normal. In people who have restrictive lung disease, the ratio is going to be reduced. Also, if you want to know how big the lungs are, when we do spirometry, we measure the vital capacity, but the vital capacity could be reduced because the lungs are small, like restriction, or it could be reduced because people have air trapped in their lungs with emphysema. How do we differentiate that? The only way to differentiate that is you have to do total lung capacity. You have to measure how big the lungs are. By definition, people that have restricted lung disease, their total lung capacity is going to be small, and people that have obstructive lung disease, it's either going to be normal or it's going to be higher, okay? Now, how do we measure responsiveness to bronchodilation? Well, the ATS has the simplest one, the one I like, is that you look at the change in the vital capacity or the FE1. If either one goes up by 12%, then we call that a significant improvement. Now, nowadays we also, in addition to doing spirometry, we also do something that's called a flow volume loop. And here what you can see is that the expiration is always on the top, inspiration is always on the bottom. And when you take a deep breath in, you blow to you start at your peak flow. It should be like a right triangle. It goes down to your residual volume, and then you take your next breath in. That's called a flow volume loop. And it should look like a right triangle on the top and kind of a semicircle on the bottom. And this is just the same thing. Now, if people have restrictors, if you look at the normals on the left-hand side and restriction is on the right-hand side of the slide, and what they're showing you here, people who have restrictive lung disease, now the dotted line being normal here, you can see their lung volume is smaller, but their airflow stays relatively normal. So that's characteristic of people that have restrictive lung disease. Their flow is lower than it should be, but it stays parallel to what you would expect in a normal individual. On the other hand, people who have obstructive lung disease, as you show on the right-hand side of the slide here, is that instead of this looking like a right triangle, it looks kind of caved in here. So instead of it looking like a right triangle, it's concave inward. And inspiration looks relatively normal. So this is a peak flow, should be up here. Peak flow is drastically reduced. Okay, so that'd be the pattern that you look for with obstructive lung disease. Now, you can see some things on a flow volume loop that you can't see in a volume time curve. And one of them is called sawtoothing, where during expiration, you see this kind of up and down undulation of the expiratory flow. It's not diagnostic of sleep apnea, but it's very common in people to have sleep apnea. Any kind of redundant tissue in your upper airway will show that pattern. And also an airway collapse pattern. In people that have severe emphysema, as soon as they start to blow the air out, the airflow goes down very, very low, and it's called an airway collapse pattern. And when you see that, usually it's going to be associated with air trapping and exercise limitation. Now, the last couple of slides we'll talk about is that this is looking at what's called extrathoracic airway obstruction. And it's talking about an obstruction that's outside the chest. I'll show you an example. Somebody has subglottic stenosis. When you breathe in, the pressure inside the trachea, it becomes lower than when they breathe, exhale, what they're showing you here is that with dynamic extrathoracic airway obstruction, when they expire, the airway actually opens up and the obstruction becomes less. When they inhale, their tracheal pressure gets less than the external pressure and the obstruction gets worse. And I'll show you what that looks like. Maybe I will. Maybe not. So this would be an example of somebody has subglottic stenosis where they had a tracheostomy tube in and the airway got much narrower. And what happens, if I do this right, okay. So this would be an extrathoracic obstruction. What they're showing you here is that when you have an extrathoracic obstruction, exhalation looks relatively normal, but inhalation looks kind of flattened so that when they inhale, the obstruction becomes worse. If you have an obstruction that's inside the chest, just the opposite happens. And this would be, say you had a tumor in your trachea. When you inhale, the obstruction becomes less, and when you exhale, the obstruction becomes more. And it's called a dynamic or variable intrathoracic obstruction. And this would be an example, a person has a tracheal tumor. And here, what happens is that the inspiration looks relatively normal, but exhalation looks flattened because the obstruction is inside the chest. And the last one is called fixed obstruction. Let's see. Okay. With a fixed obstructive defect, the obstruction is like a pinhole. It doesn't make any difference when you breathe in or you breathe out. The obstruction stays the same, and it looks like a box. It just looks like an inhalation and exhalation are both blocked. Now, I just want to spend a minute talking about bronchial provocation. For example, people have asthma. If people come in with the office and they have asthma, but they're not actively wheezing, well, you may not get much of an indication of it. And if you do baseline spirometry on them, it doesn't show any abnormality. So you can do bronchial provocation. And the main two are histamine and methacholine. Histamine and methacholine at low concentrations, normal people can breathe them and it doesn't cause anything. They're pulmonary function stays relatively normal. But if people have asthma, when you give them the concentrations, their FEV1 falls, and it'll fall to less than 20%, or it'll fall by more than 20% of their baseline value. And you can use that so that if people have asthma, it would be they would usually also have bronchial hyperactivity, and we could identify it by doing this kind of test. But just the last couple, the unfortunate part about that is that you would like to say that it was only asthma that shows bronchial hyperactivity. In point of fact, lots of other diseases could cause bronchial hyperactivity. Asthma, COPD, bronchiolitis, viral infections, kids with cystic fibrosis. I don't think I'd be doing a test on a person with a foreign body, at least not if I knew it. Near drowning, not very practical. But sarcoid occurs with those patients. So there are some populations of people that don't have asthma that will show bronchial hyperactivity. So you have to be careful not to overdiagnose.